Good morning, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, well, it's not just David Petraeus we'll talk about, although that will be a good chunk of the hour. The author of The Insurgent, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. Fred Kaplan is our guest this hour. He writes the War Stories column for Slate, but there will be other news that we'll be talking about because he's written recent columns on why Republicans hate Chuck Hagel, which is an interesting thing for us to talk about. And we'll also look at John Kerry's confirmation hearings as well. Fred is a former Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Boston Globe. He is the author of a number of other books as well. He's a frequent contributor to the New York Times. He grew up another Midwestern guy in Hutchinson, Kansas. He says he moved to Washington in 78 and worked as Wisconsin Representative Les Aspin's defense policy advisor in the House of Representatives. He was at the Globe for 20 years. In D.C. through the 80s, and as Moscow bureau chief in the early post-Soviet era. He's been at Slate since 2002. Our phone number for you to join our conversation with Fred Kaplan is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Fred.
Hi.
Thanks very much for being with us. You Midwesterner, you?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good to have those kinds of roots. Let's start with some of the – I'm always interested in personalities, and you write about David Petraeus's personality. I loved, and I heard today that it was the 50th anniversary of Robert Frost's death, and I was thinking about poetry and then read what you had to say about what David Petraeus had to say about poetry, and I'm thinking, isn't that an unusual thing for
– It was a surprise. There's a story in the book about how he went looking for a he needed a planning officer for when he was about to invade, when they were right before the invasion of Iraq. And he heard about a very talented guy at the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, named Ike Wilson, major. And he went and talked to him, and he took him out to dinner. And Wilson quickly realizes that this is a job interview, basically. He's asking him what books he reads. He's quizzing him about his dissertation. And then he asks, who's your favorite poet? And Wilson realizes he probably shouldn't fake this one, and he says, well, I don't read poetry. And Petraeus says, he just replies with shock, you know, that's unacceptable, and goes on about how poetry is a valuable thing to soothe the soul, and it helped him a lot in recovering from his own injuries, and started giving a lecture about post-World War I British poetry.
It was
one of the more surprising things that I found out about him as well, I must say.
Well, I guess if you're at the top level of somebody who's conducting war and hoping for peace, that you would go to poetry. You would want words that look at, you know, in the depths of the soul.
That's right. And of course, there were some great British poets who wrote about the time in the shell shock after the war and trench warfare, and you know, the literature, whether prose or poetry, captures some elements of the human dimension, a certain depth that biography and history are hard come to get at.
The word intellectual is used when we talk about David Petraeus. Why?
Well, he was part of a group of officers coming up through the ranks in the 70s, 80s, and 90s who were more scholarly, more intellectual, more bookish than most generals. And that's one reason why Petraeus was so disliked among a lot of people above him in the 80s. They didn't like bookish, or they didn't like officers who were bookish or who stood out too much. The genesis of this is really a story that I think has never been told before. There was a, right after World War II, West Point set up a social science department. And this was set up by, it's a very interesting story, a brigadier general named George Abe Lincoln. And he had been General Marshall's planning aide during World War II. And he was promoted to brigadier general, the youngest brigadier general in the Army. And toward the end of the war, he realizes that America is about to take on global responsibilities. And the Army needed to breed a new kind of officer. He called it, we need an officer with three heads, who knows about military, economics, and politics.
Hmm.
And so he went back, he took a demotion to colonel so that he could go back to West Point and set up this department. The best people who came out of this department, he sent on to grad school to get PhDs at government expense, and then to come back to West Point and teach for 3 years, teach a new generation of cadets. And then he still had a lot of contacts in Washington and in the Army. He would get them good jobs afterwards in command posts or the Pentagon or the State Department. And a network began to grow. And these people called themselves the Lincoln Brigade, which was a play on the, you know, the American lefties who came to the aid of the Republic in the Spanish Civil War, because a lot of people in West Point viewed these eggheads as communists. You know, they would have seminars where they would discuss things, and it wasn't just science. And a lot of the generals that we've heard about over the years who served as National Security Council aides or something, they all came out of this Lincoln Brigade. So this really had three effects in terms of my story. One, it created this cadre of people at West Point who had the impression that they were smarter than everybody else. Two, when counterinsurgency theory came along, which was an idea that emphasized political and economic dimensions of conflict over just military, this rang true to these guys who had been studying precisely those relationships. And three, it created the basis for a network. The subtitle of my book, as you said, is David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. They had become educated on how networks were really the way to get ahead, and so they were well disposed to creating their own networks when they thought it was time for them to create their own little revolution within the Army.
And you write about those books that Petraeus, I mean, he read them over and over. They were probably kind of shambled after a few years. The books that were really important to him and that guided the way that he conducted war, particularly in Iraq.
Right. Well, you know, the kind of the American way of war, as one historian called it, you know, it emphasizes superior firepower, concentrations of men and machines, you know, annihilating the enemy. Mm-hmm. That's been the tradition of American war. Very early in his career as a junior officer, right after he graduated West Point, really, in the mid-70s, Petraeus went to Paris. He had enlisted in the light infantry, and he was doing some training exercises with airborne infantry troops in France. And it was a great time for him. And he started studying up on some French literature about war, because the French had fought insurgencies. And he particularly was enticed by a book by a retired French colonel named David Galula, called Counterinsurgency Warfare. And he's reading this book, and he's reading things that he had never heard of before in places like West Point. And for example, that in wars against insurgents, military is only 20% of the effort. It's 80% political. That sometimes a mimeograph machine can be as useful as a machine gun, or concrete can be as useful as mortar shells, that money can be a form of ammunition. This was sort of a revelation to Petraeus, and when he got back to the United States, and over the next couple of decades, where he spent time in El Salvador and Bosnia, these lessons started to ring truer and truer for him. And so by the time he found himself occupying northern Iraq during the early occupation of the war, he started applying these principles to his command, and with very interesting results.
Hmm. And he was given a chance to do this. Give us a little background here. You write that a desperate George W. Bush decided to gamble, you use, on counterinsurgency in a last-ditch effort to head off disaster. He picked Petraeus, the author of this new manual. So he had no idea what this guy was going to do.
Well, it started. The first part was actually not when Petraeus was top commander in Iraq, but when he was commander of the 101st Airborne Division, right after the invasion. He was part of the the units that went up, you know, that zoomed up the desert to Baghdad. And then right afterwards, as the whole country was falling apart, he was assigned to occupy Mosul in northern Iraq, where he put some of these ideas into effect. And the interesting thing there is that there was, you know, we had, this is really kind of shocking, we had no plans at all for what to do after Saddam Hussein fell. There were no plans
at all.
That
is shocking.
And so basically the place was falling apart, and so he put in his own plans. So up in Mosul, isolated, he starts vetting people, vetting candidates for a new election, new district elections. He set up the elections. He arranged, his guys arranged for fuel trucks to come in from Turkey. He opened the border to Syria, you know, in northern Iraq. All this at his own initiative. So years later, then he goes back to the United States. He does this counterinsurgency field manual, as you said, to kind of ingrain this way of thinking into the doctrine of the army with great resistance. And then when he comes back as the top commander, George Bush does take a gamble and put not only him but his ideas in power.
Huh. And going back to Mosul for a moment, you mentioned some of what he did. He also, I found interestingly, spent a whole lot of money, like millions of dollars, on police, on irrigation projects. Money is ammunition, he said. Did people know what he was spending all this money on?
Well, that they did. There was, you might remember, one thing that happened after Saddam was ousted was they found hundreds of millions of dollars just stashed away in his palaces.
Mm-hmm.
And what the commanders did was to use this as, they divvied up and used it as a commander's discretionary fund. And some of these commanders didn't know what to do with this kind of money, and some of them, like Petraeus and a few others, used it very creatively because, again, he had read these books telling him how this kind of money should be used and how to go looking for the right people to spend it. But, yeah, he did it all on his own. I mean, he didn't say, you know, seeking permission, sir, to spend
right.
$20,000 to set up an auxiliary police force or something like that.
Right.
And, in fact, it got even more later, just jumping ahead a little bit, when he became top commander in the start of 2007, something was already in the works that we might recall under the title of the Anbar Awakening,
mm-hmm.
where Sunni tribesmen who had been shooting at us just a couple months earlier were getting very annoyed with their jihadist allies and struck a deal with us to turn against the jihadists and to join us. Petraeus expanded this throughout the country. And he set up a program called the Sons of Iraq, where he recruited Sunni militias to come join our side, and he paid their salaries with this same kind of discretionary fund. And in that case, he didn't tell anybody in Washington what he was doing, and I think if he had, they would have frowned on it. I mean, it's one thing to pay some guy to sweep the streets. It's another to pay militants who,
right,
militiamen,
right,
who were shooting at you two,
right,
weeks earlier, and as far as anybody knows, might shoot at you again 2 months hence. This was a very, very high-risk thing to do.
You know, Fred, I remember those stories now, but hearing you say this and remembering it, I'm thinking, he did what? I mean,
yeah,
all of
exactly.
These ideas are so radical.
Yeah. Well, you know, this was it. Another thing about, when he was turning the Sunni militia, another thing that he had to do was to really clamp down on the Shia militia, especially the Muqtada Sadr's Mahdi army in a neighborhood in Baghdad called Sadr City. Petraeus's predecessor, General George Casey, had never gone into Sadr City. Prime Minister Maliki had told him, stay out of Sadr City, because Sadr and Maliki had a sort of alliance. Petraeus comes along, he just goes in. And Casey had said, well, you know, you're a sovereign nation. I'm not going to do anything you don't want me to do. Petraeus just did it. So this was his style. It's, you know, one thing about counterinsurgency theory, it stems from a time, you know, it's a colonial war strategy. The British did it in Malaya, the French did it in Algiers, and at the time, you know, it's not like the British soldiers needed to get the permission of the government of Malaya to go do X, Y, or Z. They, in effect, were the government of Malaya. So this was a strategy that does require a certain kind of centralized and unified authority that doesn't really exist when we go in and invade a country. But so Petraeus just kind of, in effect, made himself the viceroy of these places where he took command.
Fred Kaplan is our guest this hour, and his book is The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. I would imagine there are more than a few people listening who served in Iraq who are part of that strategy that Petraeus was employing. I urge you to call if you happen to be listening to this particular program. We take your phone calls and emails. That's talk@wpr.org and our Facebook page, again, The Kathleen Dunn Show. To your calls momentarily, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to your phone calls now for Fred, 800-486-8655, our number is Scott in La Crosse, our first caller. Hello, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
I am old enough, way old enough, that I remember during the Vietnam War, a thing called Hearts and Minds, which sounds very much like, at least in theory, it ought to be the kind of activity that Petraeus and his group want to practice in today. And I guess my question for you is Petraeus a veteran of the Vietnam War, and how does what he's doing or what these folks do now relate to Hearts and Minds? Because my recollection is Hearts and Minds, either in concept or at least in the way it was carried out, it didn't seem to succeed all that well.
Well, Petraeus graduated West Point in 1974. So he never fought in Vietnam, but he watched the war fall apart his entire time at West Point. You know, it's very interesting that you raise that, because a lot of what these guys were trying to do was to kind of refight the Vietnam War in the right way. Their view was, we never fought this Hearts and Minds things. We never really did it. There is one of Petraeus's underlings, who's now retired, but he was a lieutenant colonel named John Noggle, wrote a book called Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, which contrasted the British success in Malaya with the American failure in Vietnam. And his conclusion was, the reason why America failed in Vietnam was because we tried to fight conventionally against an insurgency foe. Now, you know, as we now know, and as even Noggle would admit now, it was a bit more complicated than that. But these guys were saying, well, you know, we never really fought this right. And now here we are in the 80s and 90s facing small wars in places like El Salvador and Bosnia and Somalia, and we don't know how to fight these things. You know, it's interesting that the Army, which has never wanted to fight these kinds of wars, this is another thing that will just astonish people, that the definition of war in Army field manuals and that sort of thing in the 80s and early 90s, it was major combat operations against foes of comparable strength. And they referred to other kinds of conflicts against, say, you know, insurgents, terrorists, that kind of thing. They called it military operations other than war. It wasn't even war. It was MOOTW, or Mutwa. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the 90s was once overheard saying, real men don't do Mutwa. And yet this new generation of officers coming up, you know, they were fighting in places like El Salvador, in Bosnia, Somalia. It sure felt like war to them. And that's sort of the genesis of this story that I'm writing about. It is a generational conflict of these young officers coming up and saying, well, you know, as we get higher and higher in the ranks, we need to change this, because these are the kinds of wars that the United States is going to be facing, And we're not even recognizing them for what they are, much less figuring out a way to fight them.
Hmm. Can I ask a quick follow-up?
Of course, Scott.
How entrenched is this thinking amongst the ranks? I understand that, you know, you can have generals on top who, yeah, whatever their philosophy, are trying to establish that. But among the new class of professional soldiers,
right,
the ones who actually have to do this on a day-to-day basis out in the field, are they on board with it?
Well, it's very interesting. You know, we now have a generation of soldiers and junior officers. This is the only kind of war that they know. You know, we were in Iraq from, you know, it's been more than 10 years,
mm-hmm,
since we've been focusing our efforts on Iraq and Afghanistan. We have Army officers who have never even trained doing tank maneuvers, for example, who have never been in the vicinity when an artillery shell has been fired. So, on the one hand, this is a different kind of army. On the other hand, and we can get into this in a bit, but, you know, this theory did not work at all in Afghanistan,
mm-hmm,
because it was a bridge too far to think that the kinds of principles that did work to some extent in Iraq would work in Afghanistan, which was a very different kind of place. And so both the Army never fully accepted this idea, and the opponents of it have been reheartened by the failure in Afghanistan. And President Obama has, who accepted it as kind of a gamble when he mounted his own surge in Afghanistan, has now pulled away from it completely. And we now see a different kind of warfare where, you know, we're seeing it today in Mali and Libya and Uganda, you know, very light footprint wars, they call it, where we're basically fighting with, you know, launching drone strikes against particular targets or commando raids. And so there is sort of an existential crisis for the Army these days because it's unclear what their mission is. You know, mm-hmm, there's in terms of a major combat operation against a comparable foe, I mean, who would that be? Russia's not going to be invading Western Europe anytime soon. If we have a war with China, it's not going to be a ground war. The small stuff, like these operations in Mali and Libya, these are special operations forces. It's not the conventional army. So the Army is in kind of a pickle. They don't really know what their mission is. And so these ideas, I think what has happened is that there is a greater sense of flexibility within today's Army. There are junior officers and senior officers who are much more adaptable, much more flexible, who could probably adapt to changes in a conflict much better than the generation before. But what they're facing and what their whole point in life is kind of a mystery at this point.
Thank you, Scott, as always, for your call. Let's spend a little more time on Afghanistan. You write that intellectually Petraeus understood that the two wars in the two countries were very different. He had this PowerPoint briefing and a slide that read, "Afghanistan is not Iraq," but Iraq was what he knew best, so it was natural for him to view Afghan problems through an Iraqi prism. Well, wasn't he supposed to be smarter than that?
Well, you know, we all look through things through the prisms of our experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had this triumph in Iraq. I mean, the surge and the shift in strategy, at least for a while, really did bring down sectarian violence. So he's sent off to Afghanistan after Obama comes in and he decides to mount a surge. And then, you know, General McChrystal wipes out. Petraeus is sent to replace him. And, you know, this was the miracle man of Mosul, the miracle worker of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he can pull off a miracle in Afghanistan as well. And Petraeus himself felt that not only was he on trial, but his ideas were on trial. And so, but you know, when he was top commander in Iraq, that was his third tour of duty there. He really knew the place. Afghanistan, he didn't know at all. So I interviewed well over 100 people for this book and looked at a lot of documents. Many people, many of his aides told me that in Afghanistan, he'd be presented with a problem. And he would say, well, in Mosul, we did it this way, or in Anbar, we did it like that. And even in one meeting with President Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, Petraeus starts talking about what he did in Baghdad to fix some problem or another. As he was walking out of the room, Petraeus's aide, who had worked in both Iraq and Afghanistan, says to him, you know, it might be an interesting intellectual experiment for you to try not even to think about Iraq. And he said, I'm working on it. But, you know, here's the tragedy. Petraeus kind of knew that this wasn't going to work. This book that I mentioned earlier by Galula, there's a chapter in there called Conditions for a Successful Insurgency. And he lists the qualities of a country which would make life very good for an insurgency, very likely for an insurgent to win. They included a corrupt central government, a largely illiterate rural population, mountainous terrain on the plains, a neighboring country where insurgents could find sanctuary. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just mm-hmm. added up to, it was a perfect portrait of Afghanistan. And so I think that this strategy was just never going to work.
I must ask you, because it just seems to many of us, Fred, that we have been there for a heck of a long time, and nobody seems to know what's the strategy now.
We don't. The strategy now, and maybe this is what it should have been all along, is to keep pelting the bad guys on the border, but in the meantime, accelerating the training of the Afghan army and making a transition to get out of there. Even Petraeus said at one point early on in Iraq that there's a half-life to an occupation, some point at which liberation becomes occupation, and occupation is not good. And that has been the case in Afghanistan for a long time now. We see it in these blue-on-green casualties where, the soldiers that our guys are training turn their weapons against them. And it's not because some of these guys are Taliban infiltrators, but some of them aren't. Some of them are just getting upset and frustrated at the arrogance that occupation is a terrible thing for both sides. It's a demoralizing, spiritually pounding thing. And it's gone on for way too long.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Eric in Montello. Hi, Eric.
Hi. I was just wondering, I had two questions. One, how many Iraqi citizens were killed? I think the British Medical Journal said 100,000, if that's right. And number two, the Rolling Stone had an article about cargo, the big cargo planes taking pellets of $100 bills into the billions, many cargo planes into Iraq. And I was just wondering if anybody knew how much was spent on the war and what happened to all the cash that was hauled over there. Thank you.
Good questions. In terms of the Iraqi civilian casualties, there was a British medical journal called The Lancet that did a study only about a year after the war started where they estimated that 600,000 civilians had died. I did a column in Slate which disputed the statistics in that story. I thought it was a really terrible study. In fact, we don't know. We don't know how many civilians died. Probably more than 100,000 over a period of 9 years is wouldn't be an unreasonable guess. As for shipping out money, that you're absolutely right. I mean, the Iraqi leadership, I mean, it's just the Iraqi government is essentially a criminal syndicate. I mean, Karzai is very centralized. He appoints all these district governors and district leaders, and they're very remote, and they've kind of had to create, there's a lot of corruption going on to keep these guys in power, to keep them loyal, and for several years now, we don't know how much it is, but they have been shipping money out of the country to places like Dubai.
Oh my.
The idea being, I mean, there used to be a joke, although it's not really that funny, that if we announced that we were leaving on Monday, Karzai would leave on Sunday. I mean, he knows that, or there is a large suspicion that if we leave, he will meet the same fate as the last communist who was in power in Afghanistan after the Soviet Union left, namely that he'd be strung up on a lamppost. Mm. And so these guys, and that's one of the problems. These guys are not committed. Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing that has to be the case if a counterinsurgency campaign is going to work, where you're working with a local government, you have to kind of have the same interests, and we don't have the same interests. These guys are not even that committed to their own country. They're shipping money out of the country that they can use when they are ultimately exiled. I mean, it's just a terrible situation.
Yeah, it's terrible that we can't figure out some new strategy, Fred, isn't it?
As I say, the strategy is you know, make it as high, enable the Afghan army to fight their own fight,
right.
Continue to provide logistical support, maybe keep a small number of special forces there to do counterterrorism operations. But essentially, you know, it's now gotten to the point. I mean, going into Afghanistan, I mean, I see nothing wrong with that. I mean, you know, Al-Qaeda used that as the base for an attack on us. And the first thing we did was to throw Al-Qaeda out of the country. And then the real tragedy was, instead of consolidating our gains and trying to make Afghanistan a peaceful civil society, which wouldn't have taken that much effort back then. Instead, Bush goes off to fight the Iraq War. Everybody leaves Afghanistan, all the intelligence assets, most of the troops, and the Taliban come back. And by the time we come back, they're pretty solidly entrenched again.
Yeah. Eric, thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Gary in Fitchburg. Hi, Gary.
Hi. When one stops to think about all the money that's been squandered on these wars, creating more hatred for the U.S., essentially giving Iraq, handing Iraq now to, with the Shia allied with Iran. I listened to and regarding Afghanistan, I listened to General McChrystal interview last night, where he said things were going well in Afghanistan until Abu Ghraib, the torture issue, came to the fore. After that came about all these foreign fighters, these jihadists, flooded into Afghanistan and really disrupted McChrystal's plan and the progress that had been made. Mm. So,
in Iraq, the Abu Ghraib was a great recruitment poster for foreign jihadists to come into Iraq, and I thought that the Petraeus strategy really did a pretty good job of knocking them out. Some of them have come back, but really not to very much an extent. In Afghanistan, McChrystal was really saying that the problem was foreign jihadists coming into Afghanistan? Is that what he really said? I didn't see this interview that you saw, because that's just not true. I mean, the Taliban is an Afghan force, and there have always been a small number of Al-Qaeda coming from other country. But that way, I mean, talk about McChrystal, and this is something that he does not talk about in his book. McChrystal was one of these guys. He did great work in Iraq. He set up the Joint Special Operations Command, which was this, he improved that to immeasurable extents, integrating it with all other intelligence agencies, with conventional forces. He did a terrific job of doing that in Iraq. He comes to Afghanistan as the theater commander, never having done this before. He becomes a convert to counterinsurgency theory in the same way that, you know, maybe an atheist converts to Catholicism. You know, they become more Catholic than the Pope, as it said. Mm-hmm. And he has these kind of naive ideas. For example, one of his first offensives, he was going to mount an offensive in this town called Marja in southern Afghanistan. And he went around, he told Dexter Filkins, New York Times reporter, okay, we're going to kick out the Taliban, and then we have a government in a box ready to go. It's going to, you know, just come right in. We'll have ministers, police, all these things. And you know, there were people in the embassy who was telling him, look, you know, there's no such thing as government in a box, especially in a place like Afghanistan where, you know, government leaders don't even know how to put together a budget. But he thought that this was just going to happen automatically. And so Afghanistan didn't – the failure of Afghanistan has nothing to do with any infiltration of foreign fighters. It has to do with the situation in Afghanistan and the application of a strategy that might have worked in other places, but that it was naive to believe could could work in a place like Afghanistan. Mm. And he was a part of that.
Can you give us an idea? You write, Fred, about counterinsurgency being a technique, and you have to have all these things in place in order for it to work, not a grand strategy.
Right.
So what do you mean by grand strategy, and how grand strategy would be applicable in the wars that we know most recently, Iraq and Afghanistan?
Right. Well, what I meant was, you know, the way that these things ideally operate is that, you know, an administration, a political leadership, comes up with a grand strategy. For example, the grand strategy in World War II was unconditional surrender of the Germans and the Japanese. And you know, then there was a strategy beneath that, and then you left it to the military to decide the best way to do this. In Iraq, you know, Petraeus instituted this counterinsurgency field manual, but a field manual is just that. It's a kind of a how-to manual to you give to officers. Like, there's one on tank warfare, there's one on mountain warfare, and basically it says, okay, if you are find yourself in this kind of conflict, here's what to do. But, you know, in 2005, 2006, the Bush administration had no strategy for Iraq. As I said, they had no plan for what to do after Saddam Hussein fell. And so they find themselves in this new situation. Petraeus comes in with this, and, you know, Petraeus had learned from a couple of mentors of his that a great general weaves a myth about himself. Mm. Now, myths are not necessarily false. In fact, for a myth to be effective, there has to be a basis of truth to it. But he became so enmeshed with the strategy that he was pursuing that he was seen as kind of a savior. You might remember there was a cover of Newsweek with him on the cover, and it said, "Can this man save Iraq?" So it kind of became a substitute for a strategy. This might be our way out. This might be our way to redemption. And just way too much credence was put into it, and it became the strategy when, in fact, well, my final lines in my book is that the decade of wars shattered some myths that needed reassessment all along. First, that counterinsurgency is a tool, not a cure-all, and that and this was in the wake of his scandal. Then that David Petraeus is a man, not an icon.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment. Fred Kaplan, our guest this hour. His book is The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. Gary, thank you so much for your call. Lines are open for you at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is The Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And let's go to Richard in Fort Atkinson. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm pleased that it has been recognized in your program that there's a continuity between the Petraeus doctrines and ideas and the traditional colonial practices by our European allies like Britain and the East India Company in India. I think also that one of the main things that neither the traditional policy nor the Petraeus policy has really taken note of is the great cultural divide that exists in the Middle East and provides most of the energy that is driving things. At first, in the case of Iraq, it is the Sunni-Shiite divide, and we have really handed the control of that country to the faction that we consider a crucial enemy, that is the Shiites, and that the violence in Iraq continues apace. In Afghanistan, we have not recognized the fact that the Taliban is essentially fronted by, is a part of the Pashtun population, and is also which is Pakistan, and is by far the majority population there, and it gets most of its energy from that part of the culture. And then we have not given up our big policy as it was traditionally. Although it goes on under the radar, we build military bases all over the world. Chalmers Johnson's book Nemesis and its predecessor cataloged 700 bases that we have scattered around the world, and we are building more and more. For example, we are now considering to build a big drone base in northern Africa. We're building bases in Australia because we fear the influence of China in the Pacific. All of this really stretches our culture to the max. And really, when you think about it, our worldwide policy of military occupation of the whole world.
All right, I need to hold you there, Richard, because there's a lot on the table.
A couple of things. It's worth noting that the expansion of our bases, like in Australia, and naval presence in the Pacific, has been mainly at the request of our Asian allies, who are themselves rather panicked by some of the things that the Chinese Navy has been doing lately. Similarly, the drone base that we might be putting up in Northwest Africa has been very much at the urgent request of the French and the Malian government. So it works. It's not just, you know, the imposition of American imperialism or something. As for the ignorance of culture in Iraq and Afghanistan, by the time Petraeus came to Iraq, there were senior officers and intelligence officers in Iraq who really did have a pretty sophisticated understanding of the sectarian divides. And I go into some of this. There were three women in particular, three women and female intelligence officers working for the command who really had it down very cool. And, you know, one thing that Petraeus tried to do was to, he hoped that the reduction in violence that his strategy would bring into place would allow the sectarian groups to get their act together and form a unified government. What he didn't realize, and no one could foretell, was that Maliki wasn't really very interested in doing that. So we still have, although at a much lower level, sectarian violence today. As for Afghanistan, I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, we went in there for a very good reason initially, and then got stuck with no knowledge of this incredibly complex string of tribal allegiances, of tribal conflicts. We really went in there with our eyes wide shut. We had no idea. I mean, I'm reminded of a story right before the invasion of Iraq. Some Iraqi exiles who had been pushing for an invasion came in and talked with President Bush, and one of them said to him, "You know, Mr. President, after Saddam is overthrown, one thing that you have to look out for is trying to quell the tensions that will certainly rise between, you know, this is historic, it'll come back again, the tensions between Shia and Sunni." And Bush looked at him like he was talking Martian. He'd never heard of some divide between Shia and Sunni. Didn't understand that there were, you know, two kinds of, or three kinds or more kinds of Iraqis. We do have a tendency, and we're not alone in this, but because we are so powerful, it can sometimes lead to more horrible results. We do have a tendency to think that the world is pretty much like us. You know, Bush had this idea that places where dictators rule, if you blow the cap off the dictator, that essentially a society just like ours will emerge. You just have to get out of the way. And, you know, as we all now know and should have known then, that's just not the way things are.
Richard, thank you so much for your call. Bob in Middleton, hi.
Well, good morning. Thank you for having Fred Kaplan on this morning. I've been a reader of Fred's for many, many years.
Okay.
Great conversation this morning. I spent about 30 years in the military, starting out as one of those teenage helicopter pilots in Vietnam at the end of the war. And the one point that I think we're creeping around here is, if we're going to discuss counterinsurgency, it number one has to be a strategic value of what are we offering the population, which is really what we're seeking mm-hmm. to achieve, what are we offering them that the insurgents are not? And unfortunately, we see this again and again where we end up either trying to create a template for a government, which doesn't exist within the country already, or as Fred has articulated so well about Afghanistan, you have a culture there that's never had a sense of a central government that really had any strong influence over distant places like the Korangal Valley and places such as this. Petraeus and so many other officers in the service have once again, they become wonderful tactical warriors, but the strategic vision of it all has to come from politicians, just as Fred said with President Bush. Unfortunately, everything that I was going to say has been articulated so well by others. I guess my question is, will we see a military and will we see a civilian base elected leaders who actually might take time to listen to their state departments, such as things that didn't happen in the Bush administration prior to the invasion of Iraq? Will we ever see that, Fred?
Thank you, Bob.
Well, those are all excellent points and right on the money. You know, I don't in the Obama administration, it's very interesting. There is very little divide between the defense and State Departments. I've been covering national security politics for a few decades now, and I've never seen an administration more unified. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's unified in a wise way all the time. But, you know, in the discussions leading up to the surge in Afghanistan, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was as hawkish as anybody sitting around the table. Now, I suspect that what you're really talking about are listening to the people kind of in the bowels of the State Department or the Pentagon or the CIA who really do know a lot about the internal politics of these places, and whose views very often don't filter up to the top. And I think that's a problem. We are not set up like a colonial government. You know, when the British and the French had colonial governments, the entire government apparatus was geared to the colony. You had, you know, people in the British government working in India, they really knew India. They spoke the language, they knew the culture, they'd studied it. We don't have that here. We don't have a unified approach, for better and for worse. So when we go into even a place like Iraq, one of the biggest problems early on in the occupation was just the dearth of translators.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't have to, how can you win the hearts and minds of people when you're not even reading, you know, you're not speaking the same language? You know, imagine if, you know, the French helped the Americas in our revolution against the British. But the French did not come in afterwards and try to create a French-style government. Imagine if they did, and the people in charge with it couldn't even speak English, knew nothing about the American tradition, even as it existed back in the late 1700s. You can imagine the kind of resistance that might develop, even though our larger strategic interests might be the same.
And thank you so much for the call, Bob. We only have about a minute left. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about what happened to David Petraeus. Were you shocked by the whole Paula event?
Well, when it came out that he was resigning because of an extramarital affair, I was the first one actually to write a column saying that the extramarital affair was with Paula Broadwell.
Right.
But it had been suspected for some time, although I think everybody, including me, we were shocked because, you know, this goes against the code of the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Right.
I think, though, what it is, it goes back to this point I was making earlier about how Petraeus, his whole mode of operation was kind of doing things his own way. And he would succeed, and it was usually to the end. It wasn't a nefarious kind of thing he was doing. Well, this is the way I have to succeed, and nobody else is doing it, so I'm going to kind of create my own rules here. But I think that once you do that a few times and you get away with it, your moral compass begins to go awry, and I think that might have been what happened in this case.
Mm-hmm. Well, Fred, you know so much. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you. This was really fascinating. Thanks a lot. I really enjoyed it.
Good. We did, too. Great, great hour. Fred Kaplan, the book is The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program and doing on-air producing as well. Tomorrow during this hour, remember our book club? It's The Awakening. Kate Chopin, The Awakening, tomorrow at 10 o'clock. And so I hope you've read the book. If you haven't, you'll still find it a fascinating conversation because it was the history of this book is really compelling. So until then, listen to great conversations ahead. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.